We're live. Okay.
Hi. Hi, everybody. This is David Graeber Institute. I'm Nika Dubrovsky, and I'm very happy to introduce Ann Pettifor, Mike Hudson, and Professor Steve Kim. So we are going to our, I think, third conversation around what's going on now in the world and how we are witnesses this amazing end of capitalism as we know it. So I will hand to Ann, but first I want to say that I'm speaking from Kenya, Nairobi, that is experiencing now an amazing transformation as all East Africa, and the Graeber Institute is hoped to establish here an educational institution with Michael Hudson, Steve Keen, and Ann Pettifor, and many others as a professors, hopefully. So please join us. Ann? Maybe Steve, if something.
Okay, so I introduce myself or just... Professor Steve Keen, I've been, as with Michael, we've both been focusing on the role of private debt in causing capitalism's booms and busts and ignored by the mainstream, which is why the world continues falling into more crises caused by private debt booms and busts. And Michael and I are doing our best both to reform economics and try to reform the economic system.
Ann, hi, hello. My name's Ann Pettifor, and I am a disciple of Michael Hudson's and an old friend of Steve Keen's, and we've worked, all of us, on sovereign debt as well as private debt. I'm currently working on, or just about to publish a book called, titled The Global Casino, How Wall Street Gambles with People and Planet. So that's me.
Would you?
Yeah. And Michael? Oh, no, now Michael's mute. Oh, no. Yeah.
Michael, okay. So, Ann, maybe you can introduce Michael.
Hey, his sound's not working, mate.
It's funny, we're going in and out.
Yeah. Oh, no.
What do you think is happening?
We should precede all internet shows with an extract from Get Smart with the cone of silence in the 1960s comedy show.
So maybe, Michael, you may have to rejoin, as I've had to do.
Yeah. Okay. So, why don't you lead away about your latest book and your focus on what's going wrong with capitalism these days?
So right now, my major preoccupation is with the monetary system and with the failure of democracy, with failure of the monetary system to reflect democratic mandates. So we have a problem here in Britain. Once again, we're still living through an era of austerity, and our government is assuring us that there is no money to do what is needed to transform the economy away from its dependence on fossil fuels. And that's largely because the monetary system, and in particular the central bank, works against the democratic interest, works against the interests of the state. It circumscribes, if you like, the fiscal authority, which politicians can manage and do manage. It circumscribes that and limits the ability of politicians to obtain the finance they need for reversing this era of austerity. And that's because the central bank is managed by technocrats, deliberately managed by technocrats, by so-called independent central bankers. And in my view, they're not independent. They work primarily in the interests of the private financial system and not in the interests, if you like, of the wider public. And that's the reason, in my view, for why we see a rise in authoritarianism. We need to restructure our system. We need to end this era of so-called central bank independence. And we need to integrate, if you like, the two big foundational institutions of the state, which is the central bank on the one hand and the fiscal authority on the other. And until we do that, I think we're going to see, more and more Donald Trumps elected across the world as societies demand protection, if you like, in the way Polanyi argued, demand protection from market forces, which are basically impoverishing us and preventing society from doing what we need to do to A, survive, and B, to ensure the survival of the planet. That's where I am at the moment.
And Michael, we still can't hear you. Oh, dear. We're having real technical issues. First of all, Anne's sound didn't work. Now Michael's sound appears not to be working. So apologies for that stuffing up the whole discussion. Looks like Anne can't hear me at the moment either, which... Okay, well, I'll do my best to summarize what I'm working on. The main thing I've been working on is the insanely stupid predictions that economists have made about climate change, which are juvenile. That's the best way I can describe them, is the sort of thing your stupid six-year-old child might submit as a school essay before you let them go to school. Unfortunately, you weren't the parent stopping the neoclassical economists like Nordhaus from publishing their stuff. They've fooled us completely about the severity of what we face. And I think we're going to find out the hard way with catastrophic events basically destroying our capacity to maintain our production systems. And that'll start happening, if we're unlucky, in this decade, if we're lucky, maybe in the next decade. And at that stage, all the structures of capitalism will fall apart, certainly the banking system. At the same time, we have a completely naive view of how the banking system operates that's promulgated by mainstream economists, not because it's of any benefit to the ruling class or anything like that. It's just the model they have basically has banks being what they call intermediaries. Banks enable savers to lend to borrowers. Therefore, when debt goes up, it's just a change in who can spend the money. There's no change in the amount of money. But in the real world, bank lending creates money. If you get more borrowing, you get a boom. If the borrowing collapses, you get a slump. Those booms and busts are what have been occurring since we had the push towards deregulating the financial sector and central bank independence, as Anne was saying. And if they were right, we wouldn't be doing this show because there'd be no catastrophes to report upon. But there's just a never-ending series of economic and social and political catastrophes around the planet these days. And it shows, first of all, that the issues that Anne and I focus on, and Michael as well, which is the level of private debt and the role of the private financial system, that must be completely different to what the people managing the economy think is actually going on, because they ignore the private banking system and think all problems are caused by government spending. Now, they're actually making the problems worse by slashing government spending, which cuts down the amount of money in circulation, which undermines the poor, because it isn't Rupert Murdoch who goes to intensive care, accidents and emergencies and asks to be covered by the state. It's the poor. The rich can still pay for medical care. The poor can no longer get it. And that's a large part of what's causing social breakdown as well. So we have a combination of self-interest and ideology, meaning that capitalism is functioning extremely badly at the moment, and that's nothing compared to what will happen when we start seeing serious climatic breakdowns. So we're trying to prepare for what could well be the end of capitalism. Ironically, at the same time, we're watching the rise of a country which is normally put down as being communist, which is China, but it's actually showing a far more effective combination of the mixed economy, both private and public enterprise in China, are far more effective than what we're seeing in the West. So In a strange way, people always say, can you give us a country that's doing what you're talking about and show whether it's doing better or worse than the ones who follow mainstream economics? That country now exists, finally, and that's China, because it didn't have any of the hang-ups of mainstream economic thinking getting in its way. So we have an example of what our societies could be like with what China's achieving right now, combined with the breakdown of the capacity to maintain these systems, because we're listening to stupid economists who have no idea of what global warming means, have trivialized the dangers. We're about to find out the hard way they're wrong. As we find them out, we're likely to find that the productive capacity of the capitalism, and certainly its banking system, is going to fail.
And all of the problems that we faced here in the West or in advanced economies are really amplified in low-income countries. One of my real disappointments is that, you know, 25 years ago, we ran a global Jubilee 2000 campaign to cancel the debts of the poorest countries. We mobilized hundreds of millions of people across the world. And now we're having to do it again. I'm about to travel to Ghana. Ghana is in a dire strait, like many African countries, with very high levels of debt owed to private creditors, as well as to public creditors. Ghana spends something like 75% of her budget revenue just simply servicing her debts. And
that's foreign debt, Anne. That's foreign debt, not domestic government debt, but foreign debt.
Well, it is both domestic and foreign.
Okay.
So she uses 75% of her budget revenue to service both domestic and foreign debt. And the point is that she was persuaded to do so by the IMF and the other institutions, which back in the day, in about 2013, 2014, encouraged Ghana to borrow on the international capital markets at very high usurious rates of interest. And this is where Michael and I come together most forcibly, because we both feel very strongly about what the rate of interest can do in extracting wealth from those who lack wealth. And right now, the countries of the South are suffering extraordinarily from this private finance, this unregulated, largely unregulated private, global private financial system.
Mm.
Have we lost Michael?
Michael's muted.
Can you hear?
You're muted. Can you hear us? You can't hear us. Oh dear.
You can hear
Michael. Can you hear us? Just not if you can hear me. Okay, you're muted in Restream. If I see on the symbol, I can see you've got a mute symbol there, and you can't see it if it's on full screen. But if you okay,
if you look at the bottom of the screen, you can see.
If you move the mouse down to the bottom, a bar will come up. There'll be a microphone there. There should be a mark through it. Just click on the microphone. Oh dear. What do we do?
Right.
I feel like slaying a clip from Maxwell Smart when Max insists he's going to talk to the boss inside the cone of silence. And boss says, not the cone of silence, Max, please, not the cone of silence. They go inside there and they try to communicate and they have exactly the same fast we're going right through now. Now, that was a comedy show from the 1960s. And crazily enough, modern technology gets us in the same situation.
Michael,
have you worked it out yet?
Can you hear Michael?
No, Michael. Oh, dear. Hang on. I'll give some suggestions, mate, and hope this works. Press your escape key on your keyboard. Press your escape key on the keyboard. Okay. Now you should see a much, much smaller window, but down the bottom you'll see a microphone and a camera symbol next to each other, and there should be a slash before the microphone symbol. If you click on the microphone symbol, it'll turn that slash off. Have you done that? Can you say something? Oh, dear. You don't have your microphone connected, the DGI person is saying. So, what do we do? What do we do, Anne?
I'm not sure.
Put Nika in. Yeah. Michael's disappeared. Yeah. Sorry, people on YouTube.
Does Michael have to go into his settings and reset it because of...
Possibly. Oh, dear. This is the modern version of for the want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For the loss, want of the shoe, the horse was lost. For the loss of the horse, the battle was lost. We're in that situation. So
yeah.
42 people are watching. My God, you've got perseverance. Good on you.
So, Steve, what are you doing at the moment? Where are you at the moment?
Living in Amsterdam, I think you know, and I'm
And
working on a series of YouTube interviews on private debt and house bubbles around the world. So I've did one on Australia's house
right.
price bubble, and the fact that the Australian government there, typical of governments around the world, has
Yeah.
brought out a scheme to drag first home buyers into buying a home. You can buy with a mere 5% deposit. Isn't that great? 5% deposit translates as a gearing ratio of 20 to 1. So you are absolutely exposing yourself to leverage. You've got to borrow, and because the house prices are ridiculous, people are going to massively in debt because of it. And it's likely to pump up the house price bubble, and then it'll come crashing down at some point in the future because a large number of those people who take up those loans won't be able to service them. And we'll see a crisis coming out ahead of time. And to me, it's just disgusting that our
Yeah.
current generation of politicians are basically feathering their nests as a
Yeah.
side effect to not understanding how the monetary system works and
Yeah.
being guided by economists who are completely clueless about how the economy functions as well. And we're
Yeah.
basically watching, like, we've got a bunch of Keystone Cop idiots at the wheel of the Titanic,
Yeah.
and we're all aboard the boat trying to get them, don't hit that white thing. It's not a cloud. It will not clean the hull. Repeat, it will not clean the hull. It will crush the hull. Please do not hit that. Fuck, we've hit the iceberg. That's the sort of feeling that I feel like I'm in today.
So, Steve, you and I first met way back in the 90s when
Yep.
we were, and you were looking at the housing market then in Australia.
Was it in the 90s then, or was it the early 2000s? I'm trying to remember. Was it when you came to speak in Sydney at the, and you spoke
No,
it?
but well, I was aware of you before that. Maybe
Okay.
you're right. Maybe it is early 2000s.
I
It's
think it
only
was, yeah.
25
You
years ago.
just about to
Yeah.
publish your The Coming World Debt Crisis book, which of course qualified you as one of the people who saw the crisis coming.
Yeah, but I published that in 2006, and you and I were met up before that. My point is this, that we were equally pessimistic early in those days, well before the 2007-9 crisis. I'm even more pessimistic now. What's really extraordinary to me is that this vast bubble of debt, relative to global income, is sustaining itself. What's extraordinary is that the American economy, despite massive imbalances, is still sustaining itself. And so I think I'm back at where, it's not a system that can survive because it's not a stable system. But on the other hand, the timing of it is something that I couldn't get right. I mean, when I published my book in 2006, I was convinced that the book would come out far too late, that the crisis would have happened, and that the publisher's insistence on calling it the coming First World Debt Crisis was a big error because it would have passed by the
Yeah,
time.
but it hadn't, of course. She came
But
out
it
ahead of the scope.
hadn't. It took the whole until August 2007, and most people never saw the crisis until layman's 2008. So where do you think we are now, Steve?
I don't think the private debt is the same critical danger it was back in 2007, because to have a crunch like 2007, you have to have a large rate of increase of private debt, which gives you a large component of aggregate demand and aggregate income and pressure on asset prices as well that comes out of credit. Now, when you go back and look at the American data, for example, of course, that's the one that I've most focused on, the level of the change in private debt in 2006 was equivalent to 15% of GDP. And what that meant was total demand in the economy was about 1.15 times GDP because of the additional contribution from credit. Michael, let's have a bit of a chat here. We've had a bit of a chaos here, so we've just go extempore here. But back at, we were all doing this stuff. We're talking 20 years ago, and all of us were real still trying to work. We knew that there had to be a role for private debt in the economy. That's what unified all of us. We had that shared perspective. I hope Michael comes back in time to hear this. And we were being criticized not just by the right, the neoclassicals, who basically ignore us. Don't worry about those idiots down the corridor, those lefties. We give them a few tutorials to go, and we ignore them. Otherwise, don't bother listening to what they say. They're just stupid. And then what they say happened. Oh, fuck, they're not stupid. They're a threat. Let's get rid of them. That became how the economics profession reacted to people like you and me. But I knew that credit had to play a role. I was influenced by Hyman Minsky, of course, by Irving Fisher. They're all people I'd read before the crisis came around. Then I built my mathematical model of the crisis in the early 90s. And But I still hadn't logically worked out how I could explain that an increase in debt added to aggregate demand. And I remember with Michael and I, we met up once in New York. And this is just one of the cameos. He came to my hotel room, and I'm working away on my laptop. And he asked me a question saying, what is aggregate demand? And I simply said, it's income plus the change in debt. And his typical Michael went, why can't other people see that? Now, in fact, we were slightly wrong, okay, because it wasn't income plus the change in debt, okay, because one of the rules of macroeconomics, which everybody agrees to, even Austrian economists have to agree to this one, expenditure is income. Okay? What you spend is somebody else's income. So the part I hadn't worked out at that stage is how can a change in debt become part of income and expenditure? And it ends up being absolutely vital that you understand that banks create money, because the mainstream bullshit artists who pretend that banks are just intermediaries, they claim that, you know, if Steve gets a loan, it's actually Anne lending to Steve through the intermediary of Barclays Bank, you know. So Anne's account goes down, my account goes up. There's no effect of credit on spending unless, you know, I'm much more profligate a spender than Anne is. That's the base, the way they think. But in the real world, what happens is a bank creates debt for itself as an asset. Mm-hmm. It creates the money that the borrower gets, and the borrower then spends the money. Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely critical that you understand that banks create money, and then it becomes, the truth is not that aggregate income and expenditure is, it's not true that aggregate income, sorry, aggregate expenditure is aggregate income plus change in debt. It's aggregate income and expenditure are the turnover of existing money plus the injection of new money. And when that new money can come from either,
Can I just play stupid while my...
Yes, please go right ahead. Yeah.
And I just want to say, so being in East Africa, it's such a different perspective than us in West.
Yeah.
So as Anne was saying, that 75% is of GDP of all countries going to paying back debt. And you know, now Africans, it looks like they're just thinking if the West stopped to extract from them, they will be like, okay, you know, it doesn't matter which system they live. They just need to get rid of the colonial extraction one way or another, you know. So that's what all these young people on the streets, that's what they're campaigning for. That's, you know, and it's much simpler system. And it looks like this kind of understanding is spreading around here. Michael, hey, do you want
to... Yeah, I changed the microphone. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I don't know why they cut off my Yeti. It was working, as you know, before. So somehow when you change, it's all there. I want to add to what Steve quite rightly has been focusing on, how banks create money. But there's a new twist in the last decade, and that's it's central banks provide the money to the banks that create money. And as the Financial Times has been emphasizing, there's been an enormous injection of central bank money into the banking system under the zero interest rate. So you have this huge growth in central bank holdings. Now they're getting rid of them. They're winding down the holdings. So is to raise the interest rates. And what that does now, for the first time, all of this is showing up as a budget deficit. And it's complicating everything. It was very easy to flood the banking system with money to operate in the way that Steve explains. With the reserves, the bank reserves that the Federal Reserve has created, the banks can create money almost at will with zero interest. But now they all of this is being wound down, and it's draining the whole system. And that seems to have been an unanticipated. Treasury Secretary Bessent has been writing all this and saying, you see, the Federal Reserve had a gain in function, sort of like creating the COVID virus for all this. So now we're in a situation where the Obama administration bailout of zero interest rates never thought, well, what do we do when we end the zero interest rates? Mm. What do we do when the interest rates rise and we drain everything from the banking system? This is creating the crisis right now, a new unanticipated crisis right now.
Yeah, I think that's that. Like, what actually happened with quantitative easing, and this was the mainstream did not see the crisis coming. Now, actually, I'm reading Bernanke's speech to the Congress in 2007, uh-huh. telling him what a great year 2008 was going to be. So I'm going to put that up on YouTube recently and embarrass the pants off Bernanke. Not that he'd ever watch it. But so they had said no idea the crisis was coming. And then when it happened, they borrowed an idea from Richard Werner, the idea of quantitative easing. And what that meant was the central bank was buying bonds off the private sector. And if the central bank buys bonds off the private banks, it just means that they swap bonds for reserves. There's no effect on the money supply. But when they buy bonds off the non-bank private sector, that's paid for by the non-bank private sector reducing its bank deposits, which destroys money. Okay, but then the bonds then get transferred to the central bank, and the central bank could buy all outstanding bonds tomorrow. It's got an absolutely unlimited capacity to buy those bonds. Well, that creates money in the bank accounts of the non-bank financial institutions, and they're required by their charters to use that money to buy non-financial assets, things like shares and houses. So QE set off an enormous bubble in asset prices, which is still benefiting the rich and still meaning the young poor can't buy houses. It's been right. catastrophic. But when we went through COVID and we had the beginnings of an inflationary surge caused mainly by the impact on COVID on the production system, the brain dead models that these economists use, the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models they believe in, tell them that if you want to bring down the rate of inflation, put up interest rates. Now, what they were not conscious of, and this is why I find their ignorance on this front quite stunning, is that when you put up interest rates, that devalues long-term bonds. So if you have bonds, the ultimate bonds are called consols, which last forever. And if you have an interest rate of 1%, and the consul saying selling for $1,000, and you put the rate up to 5%, that consul is now worth $200. So by increasing interest rates, you reduce the value of long-term bonds owned by both the banking sector and the non-bank financial institutions. And that's the major reason why Silicon Valley Bank crashed, because that bank mainly, as its assets were mainly long-term bonds, it didn't have much in the way of loans. But when the increase in interest rates occurred, its bonds were devalued, and that's what sent it bankrupt. So what we've had is central banks putting up interest rates to control the rate of inflation. Done bugger all on the rate of inflation. What it's mainly done is make the financial system fragile. So I don't expect a crisis in terms of a massive level of private debt, you know, causing a bubble like the subprime bubble in 2007. But all these banks have only survived by pretending that they're going to hold those bonds until maturity, holds a maturity, which means they don't change the value of those bonds because they say we're not marking them to market. Well, that fiction is the only reason I think the financial system still survives. And in some ways, the central banks, whose main responsibility is to preserve the financial system, could well have destroyed it if it wasn't for the accounting fiction of hold to maturity on bonds.
Can I just say that you know, this is really true, but Steve is right. This is what's happening in the United States with quantitative tightening and here in Britain. But just to go to Nika's point, in Africa, they don't really know what you mean when you say banks create money, because they don't have those powers. If you think of countries like Malawi, Malawi does not have the institutions, the public institutions, actually, and that's not by accident, it's by design. The IMF and the World Bank have always discouraged countries like Malawi from investing in building public institutions and public capacity. And so as a result, they don't have the powers of the central bank, you know, to create money. And they'll be puzzling and thinking, well, you've got a first world problem, your problem of quantitative tightening. We're in a position where actually, you know, our central bank now. That's not true of all central banks in the South. You know, South Africa's central bank is a deeply conservative institution and behaving very much like the Fed and the Bank of England. But in other countries, there just isn't, if you like, the monetary capacity, you know, to create the money needed. Correct me if I'm wrong. This is the strong impression I get from knowing about those countries. They have become totally dependent on foreign currency, on importing other people's currency to survive, you know, whether it be US dollars or Japanese yen or sterling.
To then buy imports for their industrialized, yeah, attempt to industrialize.
To finance their payment for pharmaceuticals and for oil, for example, energy.
Yeah, yeah. And therefore they've got foreign debt, which is the most dangerous form.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, so we need to remember when we, with those of us living in advanced economies, that actually we still have a kind of power. One of my problems, the whole question of the power of central bankers and the so-called independence of central bankers, is that politicians, elected democratic politicians, fall for that game. They don't have the spine, or if you like, the courage to challenge the technocrats and to demand. And of course, people like Trump are challenging. Trump the Federal Reserve, and mainly he's using it to mount a racist attack on the only black person on the Federal Reserve's board. One, by the way, that is largely defending the full employment mandate of the Federal Reserve. But, you know, those are first world problems. Where Nika is at the moment, it doesn't feel like that. It doesn't feel that the institutions of the state have that power. I just throw that in for discussion.
Mm. You also don't, what's the private banking system like in Africa as well? And I know that's a large question, but what I've heard is there was so little people had capacity or exposure to bank accounts, that's where a lot of phone-based banking was developed. And you basically have telecommunications companies providing banking services rather than the actual banks. Is that correct?
Especially in Kenya.
Mm.
Yeah. So people make financial transfers, but they're doing using their phones to do it. And they don't have a lot of borrowed money behind them. Is that correct?
Yeah. But they also have a big movement, cooperative movement, including in banking. And I don't really understand how it works, but I know about US that cooperative banking was perfectly fine after collapse in 2008, because they knew their clients, they didn't do any of this crazy mortgages and stuff like that. So they actually didn't need any bailout. So looks like Kenya, for example, and probably other African countries, they have their own system that was suppressed because of this neocolonialism, but probably now we may have some other system emerge here, at least that's the hope. You know, that would not be like fascism or liberalism, something else, something better.
Hmm.
A big change in the whole system occurred in 1913, when for the first time the central banks were made independent of the treasury with the objective of serving the commercial, the central bank was made independent with the object of serving the commercial banks explicitly against the treasury. Well, suppose that there weren't central banks of this sort today. What if you just had the treasury? That would that's essentially what you have in China. And one of China's great advantage is it doesn't have a central bank serving the commercial banks, because it's the government that creates the money and credit, not a independent financial sector that then makes money financially by asset price, lending for asset price inflation. That really makes all the difference in the world, that China managed to keep, by keeping monetary policy in the treasury, it's made banking and credit creation a public utility, not a not privatized and financialized and making money by making loans to increase real estate and stock and bond prices instead of to finance actual capital formation and factories and employment.
And it's actually fun to watch. I mean, this is probably the year that China first came to prominence as a general concept in Western news, because we've been focusing on China ourselves for decades, but its growth has been so dramatic that only in the last couple of years you can no longer say, oh, that's a bunch of socialists, they're just copying our technology, yada, yada, yada. Now they're outdoing America in virtually every field. And we finally have an example. People keep on saying, if you're so smart, what countries adopted your ideas? We used to say, no countries adopted our ideas. Now we can say, well, roughly speaking, China. And that shows the rate of per capita growth in China is absolutely stunning. It's been averaging about 8 or 9% growth per annum in the, and that's the per capita average income in the country, whereas UK and America would be running about 1.5%. And what that means, people don't normally understand these numbers because the, it doesn't, people don't think exponentially, but a double, an income rate of growth of per capita income of 8 or 9% means you double your standard of living every 9 years. A rate of growth of 1.5% means you take 45 years to do it. Now, if those rates of growth were kept up, and of course they won't, but if they were sustained, in 2070, the per capita income in America and the UK would be twice what it is now. Per capita income in China would be 64 times what it is now. And that just shows the enormous difference between the crazy, neoclassically mangled, ruling class managed banking and economic system we have in the West with the Chinese one, which, yes, okay, you can call it authoritarian, but they've actually been using their capacity to create money and to manage industrial sectors to rapidly industrialize and rapidly improve the quality of living of their people in China. And in that sense, if you ask people what's the most democratic country on the planet in each country, the country that comes up with the best answer these days is China, which is a bit of a joke for all the Rockefeller Institute types.
Yeah. There's a reason that the West does what you say is crazy, and it wasn't crazy for the 0.1%.
Yeah.
What they wanted was precisely what's holding the economy back. They wanted deindustrialization. They wanted to make money financially, to make money in their sleep, as John Stuart Mill said, simply by capital gains. And they wanted
they'd done it another way while they were asleep.
The 99%. They wanted the 99% to be impoverished by the debt service they had to pay to the 1%. And it was the 1% that used all the financial gains to buy control of the political process in America. It's all campaign donors get to appoint the who's on the ballot to be elected, and once they're elected, who gets to buy the chairmanship of the banking committee and the, all of the other committees of Congress. So this was a planned economy, but it's planned by the 1%, not on behalf of the 99%.
I think actually you better say the 0.1%, Michael, because you're not even near the income and power, the 1% of the population. It's really the 0.1% and the 0.01%.
Yeah.
That have done that. Like, you're quite right. I normally rubbish people who say that it's the ruling class planned this. Because if you look at the capitalists, the industrial sector, they've been screwed by all this stuff. But
yeah.
You're right. If you identify the financial capitalists, the ones who want to make money out of debt, then they're the ones who've managed to get the system reorganized to cause asset price inflation, which benefits them, to enormous amounts of private debt pumped out as well. They're not the ones in debt. They're the ones who lent, creating the debt. So, yeah, the 0.1 or 0.01% is redesigned capitalism the way it wants to work, and it's going to crash. It'll bring them down ultimately as well, but we're going to go first.
Part of my problem with the 1% theory, with which I'm not going to argue, is that it disempowers, in a sense, the 99%. And one of the things we really have to reckon with is the fact that our political parties and our political organizations and the labor movement has, in a sense, disempowered itself.
Mm.
You know, it's allowed itself to be disempowered and to be depoliticized. And this is the thing that I think we've really got to grasp, which is that the power exercised by those technocrats is supposedly apolitical. It's supposedly independent. We have to show that the very fact of independence is highly political. It's political in the sense that it serves the interests of the 1%. My question then is, where are the rest of us? Where are our organizations? Where are our democratic bodies that are really should really be defending the interests of the 99%? And of course, most of them, if you think of the centrists, they've been captured and they've been bought up, and so they've been silenced. But our political institutions, parties, you know, or I mean, I think this is showing up so clearly in America, where the Democrats as a party are, you know, spineless, but where individuals like Mamdani are beginning to express the will of the base, if you like, of the people suffering under the cost of living crisis. That's happening to an extent here in Britain with the Green Party as well, with Zach Polanski. But it's just incredible that there is no voice. There has been no voice, should I say, for the 99%. That voice has been sublimated both by the 1%, but also by our own actions of sort of disempowering ourselves voluntarily. So I think there's a really big political problem here about with organizing. And Michael's quote from Hannah Arendt reminded me of that, you know, of our sort of depoliticized civil society.
Steve, it's not that the corporations have been screwed. Industrial sector itself has been transformed. The corporations are no longer led by their engineering officers, who used to be the CAOs, or the marketing managers. They're financial managers. And what used to be an industrial corporation is now a financial entity to make money by increasing the stock prices, by not investing the earnings building new factories and employing labor, but by stock buybacks and paying out as dividends to raise the stock price. So all of a sudden, we're not in industrial capitalism anymore. We're in financial capitalism. It's a transformation, not screwing the corporations, but taking them over and transforming them into something entirely different, like a parasite taking over a host and making it behave differently.
And so, as you said in your book, the parasite fools the host to believe that the parasite is critical for the survival of the host. Yeah,
making the host think that it's part of the host itself instead of external.
And we can see that with our politicians these days. I mean, I was disgusted, frankly, to watch Anthony Albanese, who's the Australian Prime Minister, come out, and I called him the prime real estate agent in Australia, because he was saying, "Go to the bank, give them a 5% deposit." They'll give you 95, they'll give you 20, you know, 19 times as much money as you put down. They'll give it to you. You're going to owe it to them, but, you know, that's your problem. Sucking young kids into the market and saying, we're going to cover the mortgage insurance as well. And like most people don't realize, with mortgage insurance, you're not insuring yourself, you're insuring the lender.
The mortgage company.
The government is the Australian government said, we're going to cover mortgage insurance. So that means you don't have to worry about raising that additional money, which means, hey, you can borrow even more, you know? And then consequently, the bubble's going to continue. But we saw the beginning of this with what's his name? Was Jack Welch, the asshole who took over General Motors?
Yeah,
General Electric,
right.
Pardon me.
General Electric.
Yeah, and he turned it from being a manufacturing company into a financial engineering thing. It looked great
and
for a while.
It up.
And then it crashed. Right? And so the thing is, what's special about this time round is, yes, we have a West which is dominated by financial capital. But, of course, we know what Marx described, the financial side. He called them the roving cavaliers of credit and said this gang knows nothing about real industrial capitalism and should have nothing to do with it. Well, at the same time, we've got the communists, actual communists in China, who are building industrial capitalism, not letting the financial sector get out of control. And the contrast in terms of the living standards of everybody in that country couldn't be greater. So we finally have a contrast to say we should let finance sector be the servant, not the master. Countries that make finance the master end up being screwed by the masters themselves and collapsing. And we're seeing that in real time while we're watching China rise at the same time.
So I want to also open this up again back into the global system, because I think there are signs of hope out there. And for me, the first one is the weakening of the US dollar. And what I'm hoping is that countries of the South are going to begin to think about alternatives to the dollar. They're beginning to think about that. They haven't come up with it. The G20 is meeting in South Africa soon. I doubt they'll discuss it there properly. But there are rumblings going on. There's an awareness, A, that the confiscation of Russia's financial assets deposited in the Federal Reserve was a contravention of international law. The same applied to Venezuela, of course, and other countries. And you know, many in the West are aware of that, but by doing that, what they have done is to shake confidence in the system. So that, for me, means that we're at a stage of, you know, transition here. The other thing that gives me hope is that southern debtors, mainly African countries, have set up a club of borrowers at UNCTAD, at the United Nations Conference on Trade and
Development.
Thank you. But because the point is that we've always argued that there is a creditors cartel out there in terms of the international financial system and the debts owed. But the, and that cartel is organized by the Paris Club on the one hand, the IMF on the other, whereas the debtors are not being organized. Now, just now, as we speak at the World Bank meetings in Washington, the debtor nations have set up a club of borrowers. And I'm hoping that they will use their clout as a collective to challenge the West and to challenge the creditors and to demand that actually their debts should be cancelled so that they don't spend more than 10% of budget revenue on debt servicing. And with that aim, they can possibly do that as a club of borrowers. So there is hope, and the hope, I think, comes from what's going to happen outside the Western system over the next period.
Steve, you mentioned insurance, and I want to bring up a point that'll be close to your heart. You're right. The insurance is to insure the creditor, not the debtor. And in the United States, the insurance, the home buyers in Florida and in places that are threatened by extreme weather have found their all of a sudden their insurance rates go up thousands and thousands of dollars a year, and they were spending all of their money. Up to 43% of their income for mortgage debt service, which is what the government insures after the banks. But all of a sudden, there was this increased insurance because of the flooding in Florida and the flooding in the Midwest. And the result is that real estate in Miami and on the seacoast of the United States is now unsaleable. If they do try to sell, it's a crash. You're back in the situation of 2008, jingle mail. Best just to walk away if you want to buy something else. But who's going to want to buy a house where you have to pay this enormously high insurance rate in addition to the mortgage rate? This is something unique in America.
But I think it's not unique, Michael. It applies here in Britain as well. And the thing about this is that the insurance companies are declaring whole areas, in the case of Britain, it's areas prone to flood, as uninsurable, as where they will not go. And when the insurance companies walk away, mortgage companies follow suit.
The banks walk away as well.
It's going to have a detrimental effect on the banking, the financial system. So I think it's a really big issue in the West. Is the uninsurability. I'm hoping, Michael, that Mar-a-Lago is also uninsurable.
I've been dying to call Mar-a-Lago more a lagoon for decades. So pardon me, the rest of Miami, but you're going to get wiped out anyway. So let's have a hurricane hit Miami and flood Donald Trump's, and he'll suddenly become the person who's always worried about global warming and knows more about climate change than anybody else on the planet. And if Mar-a-Lago becomes more a lagoon, we might actually manage to do something about climate change.
And all this American opposition to recognition climate change is because it wants to make oil and coal the main fuels, because that's how America, if America could control the oil trade, it can control the whole world's energy. That's why it's cut off Russia, cut off Iran. So all of this is part of the American oil-based strategy that it's had for the last century.
And of course, it's based on complete ignorance about global warming as well. I mean, and that's the real worry. We've got absolute morons in charge of government policy in the West these days.
Not morons, representative of the oil industry.
Okay, morons who are representative of the oil industry. Let's not talk about the morons. That's important.
I want to ask something again about Africa. So what I see here is a heavy presence of Chinese. They're building everything. They're presence like heavily. And one of the things I understand they're doing, they're giving a loan in yuan. And so my understanding, please comment, what are they doing? They're just dumping US dollars because they have so much of US dollars, they're giving it to the local people in Global South, but then they repay them in yuan. So this is a kind of, they replace slowly and surely whole system And they don't do this financial capitalism. They're actually building things like the roads, the buildings. Everything is Chinese here. It's like absolutely insane how quickly, like, whole Nairobi is under construction. It's just fascinating to see, like, totally new world. Probably Russia.
I want us to be careful about, you know, celebrating China, because it is true she is managing the lending process to bring about a change in the global reserve currency system. But also China has real interests in parts of China, parts of Africa. China has bought up agricultural land in order to feed her people, which has stripped local people of their rights to land. Because in many parts of Africa, I'm thinking of countries like Sierra Leone, you know, the legal rights and ownership to land is not enforced, is not there, because the criminal justice system doesn't operate. And so Chinese have been able to buy up huge swathes of land. And not just China, but of course Saudi Arabia and those countries, who all are looking ahead and see what climate breakdown is.
Also Turkey very present.
And the question is, you know, do the Africans have robust systems to resist this kind of takeover, actually? Because it's not always benign. It's not always friendly.
I'd rather have Chinese nefarious behavior than American nefarious behavior.
I don't know.
It's a challenge. Yeah.
I think they're all for independent now. It looks like there's Gen Zs who like took over Madagascar now and just going everywhere. I think they're like, okay, enough is enough. Now we're going to run ourselves. They're just trying to figure out how to do that. And that's kind of open question. So it's in this case, I think it will be so valuable if the people like you, who saw how the system developing wrong, you know, come over, and you're going to Ghana, I know, Anya, and just just share the ideas of what would be like the system that doesn't have a constraint, you know, that would be built from the beginning for the people, by the people.
So I have been campaigning for the last 2 years for Africa to introduce a clearing union, so it does not need to use dollars to trade with each other. But that would require for Africa to, in particular for countries like South Africa and Ethiopia, that are on the whole more prosperous than most, to actually positively engage in trade with their partner countries in Africa. And if they did that, you know, Africa could easily feed itself, and I'm sure that they could easily maintain themselves, really, through trade. But they need a system where they don't have to rely on the US dollar as currency in order to trade with each other. And so I've been arguing for this because in Europe after the Second World War, the Marshall Plan was not the thing that revived activity in Europe. It was the establishment of the European Payments Union, where the Europeans got together and formed a small clearing union for themselves. And what that did was that instead of them using all their money, their dollars that they were given through Marshall Aid, to buy American kit, they began to make their own kit and trade with each other, and that enabled them to generate their own currency and their own incomes, instead of just being importers of American kit post-war, which is what the Marshall Plan was about. The Marshall Plan was, we'll give you the dollars, you buy our stuff. And the Europeans had no choice, because they were in a state of complete destruction. But when they learnt about trading with each other without using a currency through a clearing union, where the only imperative is not to build up a deficit or a massive surplus, and the system should be one that is managed in the way the central banks manage banks, and ensure that those who build up a deficit, then have to start producing to make things in order to eliminate the deficit, and those who build up a surplus have to start buying stuff from those with deficits in order to help balance the system. That was all that is required. And I'm trying to persuade the African Union, because the African Union is unlike the Latin American states. There is actually a degree of cohesion in Africa. They have an African Union. They do meet in Addis Ababa every so often. There is more cooperation, both at a regional level in Africa, but also at a continental level. And so they are ideally placed to set up their own clearing union, and in that way to escape both from the dollar, but also ultimately from the Chinese yuan, because ultimately the Chinese are also imperialist in their ambitions.
So if you're going to do that, and they're not going to use the Chinese yen or gold, then you need a Keynesian-type new BRICS bank to create bankors. And they will all use this bankor money as of credit and debt is yeah. the transition.
So in my opinion, Michael, they don't even need another currency. They actually just need a balancing item.
And that was what the bankor was, by the way, Anne and Michael. I've just recently reread all Keynes's documents. I wasn't aware of this detail, but the bankor was not a currency. It was a unit of account. And therefore, you simply you had a conversion rate between each currency and the bankor itself. A lot of critics of it, and I won't say who they are, but you know what I'm talking about, say, oh, that was all about a fixed exchange rate. There's no need for fixed exchange rate with this. It was just when Keynes talked about the bankor, that was the system. There were fixed exchange rates. He didn't think of floating exchange rates. But you could have floating exchange rates with a bankor system as a payments mechanism to enable trade to occur. And the focus, again, which was Keynes's as well, and extremely necessary, to minimize the scale of trade surpluses and trade deficits.
Absolutely.
So, if they're on that direction, they can get there, and they could do it quite sensibly as a continental idea.
Yeah. So that's what I'm arguing. But, you know, and we're hoping that they get their meeting, the G20 meeting in Johannesburg very soon. But I don't think that the South Africa is not in a state yet to adopt such policies. But I would hope that in other African countries, they begin to think about the establishment of a clearing union and of trading with each other and not becoming dependent on the great Western powers or even Eastern powers.
This is the crucial things I also believe is education. I didn't know about this European the relationship between Marshall Plan and you know, like European countries learn to trade with each other. So here, especially, it's a lot of proposals to start to do lectures before the university, and maybe that's the things that should be done, you know, just to educate people, because people are so eager to figure out how the new world could emerge. Michael, we just try to edit your lecture too. It will be amazing to put together exactly lectures, not only discussions, but maybe lectures and then discussions.
In the form of a book. And that'll make, we have to identify ourselves as a group, and the group has this common economic approach. That's how we establish it. Not just as individuals, but as
Happy to be under the umbrella of the name of David Graeber as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the point is that I have personally written articles, Nika, on this idea for Africa. And there are others, other economists that have been working on it in Europeans, particularly the Italians are quite keen on this. So Luca Fantacci and my friend Massimo Amato, they're the two economists that have really brought to light the European Payments Union, how it works. And exactly that, you know, Africa is so used to, oh, we've got to rely on aid, we've got to rely on dollars, in the same way as Europeans thought, oh, we have to rely on the Marshall Plan. But in the end, they didn't have to. They had to revive their own economic capacity.
It will be really cool if we can kind of form this open discussions on Michael Hudson, around Michael Hudson and dialogues with him, into the series of lectures and then discussions. In Michael Ye's book, but also, you know, YouTube streaming is really good because we always have a lot of people. And I think this is ideas that have to be spread now, because now is the time when everything is changing. Books is like too long to prepare, and then it's a different difficult distribution system. It's very conservative, old media. So I suggest we do lectures. So I would love to hear lectures of all of you, you know, on, and maybe in some place in Nairobi where we can open it up to the new audience.
Well, Nika, you suggested before that you'd wanted us to talk today, where is capitalism going? And we have it can go in two directions, where it's going now, or it can go in our direction. And our direction is the only way that it can, that it'll evolve into socialism, basically, or whatever we're going to call it, and survive. Let's say industrial socialism.
So, Andreas Malm has his new book out, and it's quite extraordinary. He shows that the banks have lent something like $5 trillion to the oil and gas industries, that they sit on something like $13 trillion worth of assets, and that those assets must be destroyed if we are not to destroy the planet. And in that process, we will effectively be destroying capitalism.
Yes. You wouldn't want the new bank simply to give countries money to pay back the existing debt overhead that they've got from the legacy of colonialism and imperialism.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. A debt cancellation, odious debt should be wiped off the book.
Yeah.
Like Argentina today.
Yeah. Just to mention Argentina, I'm enjoying that so much. I was in Argentina in 2001, I think, that crisis, and later as well. And here we are where Trump promises $20 billion or $40 billion to Milei, but then goes on to say that if Milei lose the election, they're taking the money back again, at which point the markets collapsed and the system collapsed. And damaged his Malay because he seemed to be just a pawn in the hands of the American.
Yeah, I mean,
he's made it a lot worse for his friend.
Yeah, I restrained myself from saying anything about Argentina when he took over because of the libertarian stuff he was going with. I'd normally attack, but I know enough about Argentina to regard it as a complete and utter basket case. And given the state of the economy, maybe something as crazy as what he tried might have worked. Because 2 years fast forward, he's back in the same old system. There's far too much foreign debt. That's their main problem. Their wealthy elites have ship their money offshore, so that the income inequality is absolutely unthinkably high in Latin America. I still remember very, very vividly reading an article by, I can't think of his name right now, but one of the authors for the Jeff Harcourt's Festschrift, and he said that the level of worker consumption in America is about 70% of GDP, 70% of consumption is workers' consumption, and about 30% is capitalist. He said in Latin America, it's the other way around, 70% capitalist, 30% worker. That's the level of inequality. But also what's happening is the Latin American capitalists are trying to keep up with the Joneses in America, and that's their main reference point. So with that level of inequality, you're never going to get the type of broad-based industrial system that was what made America great in the first place, and Milei was he didn't attack any of that, so it's come back to bite him.
There's no meaning to creative destruction.
We need creative destruction of Austrians. That's what.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So it would be fun to go to a libertarian conference right now and say, "How's your bank loan going?" It's not quite the result they expected. So I hate to, I feel terrible to be taking advantage of their failure, but hey.
So I'm sorry for the technical problems in the beginning. I hope we will be much better next time with the technical checkup and so on. I don't know. Everything was working before we started and then it was a disaster. But let's maybe talk behind the scene about the series of lectures. I will introduce you to the spaces in Nairobi that is possibly available here to do that.
And after we do that, it should be edited into a book with self-referencing ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
So that we establish ourselves as a unitary group.
Yeah, absolutely. And so thank you so much. And I hope to see you soon. And also I hope that the world will be much more hopeful soon than it is now.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Bye, everybody. Sorry for the chaos. Bye.
Bye.